loose ends across the whole spectrum of your work life and personal life and get a lot more done with less effort. Second, Stephen Covey summarizes it this way. Highly effective people carry their agenda with them. Their schedule is their servant, not their master. They organize weekly, adapt daily. However, they are not capricious in changing their plan. They exercise discipline and concentration and do not submit to moods and circumstances. They schedule blocks of prime time for important planning, projects, and creative work. They work on less important and less demanding activities when their fatigue level is higher. They avoid handling paper more than once and avoid touching paperwork unless they plan to take action on it. Peter Senge writes, "People with a high level of personal mastery are able to consistently realize the results that matter most deeply to them. In effect, they approach their life as an artist would approach a work of art. They do that by becoming committed to their own lifelong learning. Personal mastery is the discipline of continually clarifying and deepening our personal vision, of focusing our energies, of developing patience, and of seeing reality objectively. Finally, you are highly productive, unstuck, when you have these skills. 1. Clarity. You know what you are there to do at both the high level and each day. This allows you to set limits on your work. 2. Discipline. You work persistently and do not allow yourself to be distracted. 3. Focus. You work on one thing at a time and give it your full attention. 4. Energy. You have high capacity. 5. Speed. You have a quick turnaround time. 6. Estimation. You know how much you can do in a day. 7. Completion. You complete your work every day. 8. Love. You do your actions from a heart of genuine goodwill toward others and think hard about what their needs really are so you can meet them successfully. Now we need to know what to do once we are unstuck. That's the next chapter, the unstuck cycle. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. Being unstuck is ultimately a positive concept. It is getting the right things done through obstacles again and again for the good of others and the glory of God. Exercise. How are you doing at obeying the command to be abounding in the work of the Lord? 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58. Are there things you are not doing that you should start doing? Or things you are doing that you should stop doing to carry out the Lord's work? Chapter 3. The Unstuck Cycle. What do you do when you get unstuck? And how do you avoid the willpower fallacy? Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Isaiah 41, verse 10. Two mistakes we've especially made as Christians have unfortunately caused us to get stuck more. The two mistakes. The first mistake is understandable, given that it is ultimately grace that gets us unstuck. The second is ironic, for it is the very opposite of grace. But understanding it also helps us understand better what God in His grace ultimately wants us to do when we get unstuck. Getting this right is essential to truly getting stuck in the way God wants us to and for the purpose He wants us to. What are the two mistakes? Passivity. It would be a mistake to conclude that since God ultimately gets us unstuck, we should not take action ourselves. Sometimes there literally is nothing we can do but wait. In those cases, waiting is what we must do. But when there is something we can do, we are to do it. Not as a substitute for prayer, but flowing out of our prayers. This is simply a proper understanding of sanctification. We do not stop working because God is working. And neither does God stop working because we are working. Rather, God works in our working. His work is first, but we are to take action, to do what is in our power. Then we can rest, knowing that the results are left to God. Martin Luther captured this perfectly. Work, and let him give the fruits thereof. Rule, and let him prosper it. Battle, and let him give victory. Preach, and let him make hearts devout. This is why I have often said that one of the big mistakes we've made as Christians is taking a merely devotional approach to productivity. We have often thought that building emotional fervency and comfort is enough. But that by itself is a passive approach. Biblical spirituality is active. We are to run. 1 Corinthians 9 verse 24 and 26. Hebrews 12 verse 1. Labor. 1 Corinthians 15 verse 10. Press on. Philippians 3 verse 14. Work out our salvation. Philippians 2 verses 12 and 13. Strive. Colossians 1 verse 29. And pursue righteousness. 2 Timothy 2 verse 22. We need to realize the same thing about our productive action and methods and strategies that J. Gresham Machen said about the use of the intellect. No conversion was ever wrought by argument. A change of heart is also necessary. But because intellectual labor is insufficient, it does not follow, as is so often assumed, that it is unnecessary. Judging others when they are stuck. Another mistake we often make as Christians when we see people stuck is that we tend to assume laziness too quickly. When we see someone struggling with their productivity, we may assume they aren't working hard enough or that they can just fix the problem by deciding to. We hear this type of thinking in phrases like this: if it really matters to you, you will do it. And people find time for what really matters to them. I call this the willpower fallacy. Such thinking assumes that change can be made simply by deciding to make change. It fails to recognize that often the causes of the challenge are complex, and that change needs to be grown instead of installed. The skill-will matrix. Two factors may hinder you in a task. Lack of will may be one, to be sure, but lack of skill may be another. We can illustrate this with the skill-will matrix. When you plot these two factors on an axis, here's what you get. Will is on the horizontal axis, skill on the vertical axis. In the upper left quadrant, you get high skill, low will. We often wrongly assume this is the problem. In the upper right quadrant, high skill and high will. In the lower left quadrant, low will, low skill. And the lower right quadrant, high will, low skill. This is usually our problem, not laziness. Some people lack will and skill. Some have the will, but lack skill. Some have skill, but lack the will. And some have both the will and skill. With productivity, we tend to assume too quickly that the chief problem people have is lack of will, rather than lack of skill. But I propose that our chief problem is actually lack of skill. Productivity requires something more than just the decision to be productive, as important as that alone is. It requires building the capacity to be productive, the mindset, skills, and tools. And these are not always taught so well. This leads us to one of the most important concepts in this book, the unstuck cycle. The unstuck cycle. We've seen that being stuck is common. You seek to do something important and therefore likely difficult. It might go great at first, but eventually you encounter obstacles. That is, you get stuck. We've also seen that all is not lost. People who have accomplished historic feats, including Einstein, Mark Twain, and Martin Luther, have experienced being stuck, and they got through it. So you can too. The Bible also talks about being stuck and gives us the encouraging truth that the times when we are stuck are often times when God meets us in a special way. So you look to God, you implement certain methods to help you get unstuck, and with perseverance, hard work, and skill, you get unstuck. What do you do now that you are unstuck? Is that it? Obviously, you keep going toward accomplishing your goals. But there is something else you need to do. You need to help others out of their stuckness. Help others get unstuck. The biblical ethic is about glorifying God and serving others. Those who have an advantage are to use it not chiefly for themselves, but for the needs of others. As the Apostle Paul writes, I do not mean that others should be eased and you burdened, but that as a matter of fairness, your abundance at the present time should supply their need, so that their abundance may supply your need, that there may be fairness. As it is written, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. 2 Corinthians 8, verses 13 through 15. Likewise, both Paul and Peter emphasize that we are to use our freedom, our unstuckness, to serve. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. 1 Peter 2, verse 16. For you were called to freedom, brothers. Only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love, serve one another. Galatians 5, verse 13. God enables us to get unstuck, not only so we can flourish in our work and lives, but also so we can have the joy and privilege of helping others get unstuck. And do it without judgment. We need to help others get unstuck in a certain way, namely, without judgment. We should not make others feel bad for being stuck, and we should not assume that it's their fault. Life is simply hard, and we're doing challenging things. People are going to get stuck. The unstuck cycle looks like this. Try hard. Gain momentum. Get stuck. Call on God. Persevere. Apply personal effectiveness. Get unstuck. Regain momentum. Help others get unstuck without judgment. We need to help others get unstuck without judgment because the problem is often lack of skill, not lack of will. And because criticism has been shown to be an ineffective way of motivating people. And because the scriptures teach us to help others with gentleness, even if there is sin behind their problem. Brothers, if anyone is caught in any transgression, you who are spiritual should restore him in a spirit of gentleness. Galatians 6, verse 1. And of course, we must not judge because we ourselves have been stuck as well. Notice also that not being judgmental applies to ourselves. In her excellent book, The Happiness Track, How to Apply the Science of Happiness to Accelerate Your Success, Emma Seppala shows that new research confirms that even harsh criticism with ourselves does not work. So this is the unstuck cycle. Since getting unstuck is about grace, the grace that we receive from God enables us to get unstuck, and we then extend grace to others to help them get unstuck. Confer with 2 Corinthians 1, verses 3 through 7. Three traps to be careful of. Finally, there are three traps to be careful of. Thinking you're stuck when you're not. Sometimes we think we're stuck simply because things are hard. But if you're continuing to make progress and aren't experiencing huge snags, you're not stuck. Rather, you're in a dip. A dip is a temporary hard slog that you will get through if you keep pushing and don't give up. And pushing through the hard slog is actually the fastest route to the destination. In these cases, you will be especially tempted to bail. Be discerning and able to identify that you're in a legitimate dip and you're not a failure. Thinking you're not stuck when you are. Some people are stuck and don't know it. Everything can be going your way. Going smoothly and going quickly. Everything feels and seems wonderful. Yet, as we've seen, you are still headed toward a dead end, a form of getting stuck, if you are leaving God out of the picture. You are sailing to the wrong destination. This is the worst form of being stuck. That's why this chapter is so essential. We need to keep God central and look to Him first at all times. Stuck without knowing it. Depression. Depression takes us beyond the scope of this book, but I need to say something about it because it can be a huge source of getting stuck. It can be especially tough because you may not know that you have it. It doesn't come with the obvious signals that a broken leg or the flu has. Depression can have a devastating effect on your life and productivity without ever announcing itself. If you are feeling really stuck and have a sense of hopelessness or deep sadness, consider whether there might be something more going on. Depression is treatable. Sometimes getting unstuck can involve the very hard work of counseling and medication. We shouldn't look down on people who have depression, and for some reason, depression seems especially common today. For encouragement for those suffering with depression, I would recommend The Genius of Puritanism and Christians Get Depressed Too. Now that we know what to do with being unstuck, it's time to start learning how to get unstuck. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. God gets us unstuck so that we can, in turn, help others get unstuck. Doing so is a manifestation of His grace and unleashes a virtuous spiral of help in the world. And we are to do this without judgment. Exercise. Who in your life is stuck right now? What can you do to help them get unstuck? Chapter 4. Recovering Personal Effectiveness as a Force for Good. The Need for and the Call to Personal Effectiveness. Be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 58. God calls us to always be abounding in the work of the Lord. As we've seen, that is a type of being unstuck. How are we doing with that? How can we abound in the work of the Lord more fully? Central to abounding in the work of the Lord is not simply devotional fervency, but also productive skill. Skill in being able to get things done, achieve goals, and make ideas happen. After all, isn't that what Paul is exhorting us to do? He is calling us to accomplish work, and these are the very things that work involves. They are an essential part of work. And note, Paul isn't exhorting us just to try. We are actually to accomplish the work we are called to do. That requires knowing how to work, which is the skill of personal effectiveness. When used in a God-centered way, it is central to how we get unstuck. How do we get unstuck? Personal effectiveness. What is personal effectiveness? Here's a good summary. Personal effectiveness is the skill of leading yourself every day to get the right things done in the right way, for the right reason, and in the shortest possible amount of time. We could say it's knowing how to get things done, make ideas happen, and do great work. It's the skill that goes underneath everything else you do and enables you to do it. It's how you figure out what your mission is, stay on track with your mission, manage tasks, schedule your activities, keep your stuff organized, and assess problems, such as procrastination and distraction, to find ways around them. You could call it time management if you want, but it is really about much more than managing your time. Personal effectiveness goes beyond time management. Personal effectiveness includes time management, but the time management has to be based in vision and purpose and principles for our entire lives. In fact, if we conceive of time management apart from the other aspects of personal effectiveness, we will likely end up mismanaging our time. We can go further and say that being unstuck is about extraordinary achievement. It is really the science of attaining extraordinary results. It is about excellence, high performance, and flourishing. The greatest writers on effectiveness, from Jim Collins to Stephen Covey, will tell you they are actually writing about unleashing human potential and achieving extraordinary results. This is also one reason why personal effectiveness is central to getting unstuck. For being unstuck is, stated positively, about being personally effective. It is about unleashing extraordinary achievement, excellence, and flourishing. How personal effectiveness solves the three causes of being stuck. We saw in Chapter 1 that all the ways we get stuck in life and in productivity fall into three categories. We don't know what we want, we don't know how to get there, and obstacles are in the way. Personal effectiveness has three components, and they actually match up exactly to these three problems. Personal leadership. Personal leadership is about developing a vision for your life. It's the ability to know what's most important and to define where you want to go. This addresses the problem of not knowing where you are going, and it does it in a God-centered way so that you are really going in the direction God wants you to go. The way to address the problem of not knowing where you are going is to develop a vision for your life. This involves developing your purpose and mission, developing your values, developing your large life goals, and defining your roles. Personal management. While personal leadership is about vision, personal management is about discipline. This is essential because vision alone is not enough. You also have to carry it out. You know where you want to go from personal leadership, and personal management is the skills, practices, and focus involved in making that happen. It addresses the problem of knowing where you want to go, but not knowing how to get there. Personal management involves determining your intermediate goals, choosing the activities to which you will give your time, defining and managing your projects, determining your next actions, managing your schedule, and just plain doing the work. I find it helpful to use the term time management here. A lot of people don't seem to like using this term, and I myself try to minimize using it because it seems so mundane. How can you need to learn more about that? But it is actually central and not at all redundant, at least not at the pace and with the challenges we have in our day. But if you don't find the term time management super helpful, try maximizing your time or getting things done or the like. While time management is central, it is nonetheless only part of the equation. For it doesn't matter how well you are managing your time if you are going in the wrong direction. Hence, time management must always happen in the context of personal leadership. That's what so many miss. And that's why some people find time management boring. They don't realize it's about executing amazing things, accomplishing dreams. It's the concrete, on-the-ground component of making great things happen. Overcoming obstacles. Overcoming obstacles involves strategies for overcoming the challenges to your time management. But it is about more than that. It is about passion and motivation. For passion is a key part of God's power that gets you through the obstacles. It is hard to press through challenges when you are not motivated. On the other hand, being motivated and passionate not only gives you energy to do more than you otherwise could, but also yields fresh insight for overcoming future obstacles. Overcoming obstacles also involves being equipped with the specific tools for addressing problems that get you stuck, such as overflowing email, distractions and interruptions, procrastination, and lack of motivation. Personal effectiveness enables you to get unstuck because it addresses the three chief issues that get you stuck, thereby enabling you to 1. Learn what God wants you to do through the skill of personal leadership. 2. Learn how to make those things happen through the skill of personal management. 3. Keep going through obstacles. By learning the discipline of personal effectiveness, you will be more able to get unstuck when you need to. You will have the vision to know where you are going, the discipline to know how to get there and do it, and the passion and know-how to overcome the challenges along the way. Behind personal effectiveness, biblical truth, and correct principles. We can consider biblical truth as a component of personal effectiveness. But technically speaking, it is distinct because it goes behind personal effectiveness and enables it. Personal leadership isn't about just going anywhere we want. It's about going in the right direction and doing it in the right way, in line with God's commands and principles, and for the right reasons, out of love for God and others. The foundations show us the principles and truths of God's Word, which should in turn govern the development of our vision and how we spend our time. Most time management approaches focus only on strategies and tactics. They do not seek to ground those strategies and tactics, or even vision, in the most fundamental and ultimate reality of all, God's truth. But if we are to truly be unstuck, that's what we must do. Therefore, in the chapters that follow, we will start with God's truth. Related disciplines, the effectiveness triad. Personal effectiveness also relates to two other core disciplines for getting things done: management and leadership. Management. Management is about helping people unleash their potential. It focuses on the individual. It involves planning, staffing, coordinating, and so forth, with the aim of speeding up the interaction between a person's talents and the organization's goals. As renowned leadership expert John Cotter has put it, management is about coping with complexity, bringing order to things. Leadership. Leadership, on the other hand, is about coping with change. It is not about bringing order, but rather about casting a vision that changes things. It is about rallying people to a better future, as business consultant and speaker Marcus Buckingham has said so well. Note the term rally. A leader does not use control or push people, but instead rallies people, motivates them to harness their resources, to work together willingly and joyfully, to bring about an envisioned future. Leadership is above all about tapping people's intrinsic motivation. Personal effectiveness. Of course, we cannot lead or manage others unless we can lead and manage ourselves. Likewise, the people we are leading and managing will not be very effective unless they can manage themselves as well. Hence, personal effectiveness is foundational. The disciplines of leadership and management also shed light on another chief aspect of personal effectiveness: distinguishing between the roles of individual contributor, manager, and leader, for each requires different skills and approaches. The right approach to personal effectiveness includes knowing what your chief role is and tailoring your approach accordingly. We will talk about this more throughout the book. In sum, these are the three skills we need to truly get things done, make ideas happen, and bring vision into reality: leadership, management, and personal effectiveness. We are focusing on the latter because it is foundational and so often overlooked. Christian views of management and leadership can also be built on this foundation. Personal effectiveness in history. In chapter 4 of What's Best Next, I argue that personal effectiveness is biblical. Here, I want to make the point that personal effectiveness is something we see throughout Christian history among the most effective Christians. Consider William Wilberforce, the great evangelical social reformer who brought an end to the slave trade and then slavery in the British Empire. His two great objectives in life were the reformation of morals and the end of the slave trade. That is an example of the focusing power of life goals, an aspect of personal effectiveness. Or consider Jonathan Edwards, widely regarded as one of the greatest intellectuals America has ever produced, and one of the greatest theologians of all time, who created his 70 resolutions at the age of 19. These resolutions are an example of a mission statement, an aspect of personal effectiveness. Or consider John Calvin, the great reformer who is also widely regarded as one of the greatest theologians of the Christian church, who utilized feedback analysis in his pastoral ministry. Peter Drucker points out that this is one of the reasons Calvinism had such an impact in his time and after. Today, consider John Piper, who was very disciplined with his time and for decades devoted every Saturday and later Friday to sermon prep, and every Tuesday night to writing an article for the church newsletter. These are examples of scheduling and time management, aspects of personal effectiveness. And the incredible results that added up over the years are visibly evident. As all of these sermons and articles are available on his website in a well-organized, easy-to-access way. Or consider Bill Hybels, who has spoken often of how he came to discover that he was working at too high a pace and needed more regular rhythms of rest, the productivity practice of renewal. He has recently written an excellent chapter in his book Simplify about keeping our schedules God-centered and in balance, an example of time management. A force for good. I've titled this chapter, Recovering Personal Effectiveness, as a force for good. Why? First, because personal effectiveness is something we do need to recover. The secular area has seen much growth in this discipline over the last few decades. But today's Christians have generally been slow to learn from the secular material and to adapt it and use it. As we've seen, however, Christians throughout history, and some today, have used personal effectiveness. So we need to recover it. Second, we need to recover personal effectiveness for its true purpose. That is, as a force for good. It is not just about serving ourselves or gaining our own peace of mind, which is where so many secular approaches go. Just as with everything that God gives us in life, we are to ultimately use personal effectiveness to increase our ability to do good for others and serve them. Ironically, it is in this use that we will find the most fulfillment. And so personal effectiveness is, at root, a tool for advancing God's purposes in the world. We are not to neglect it. It is a gift of God's grace for furthering the common good and advancing the gospel. In our current era of overload and yet extraordinary opportunity, this powerful tool is essential for doing work in a way that is balanced and doesn't get us stuck. At the root of learning personal effectiveness is grasping the often mentioned, yet much misunderstood concept of urgency and importance. So that's next. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. To abound in the work of the Lord, we need more than devotional fervency. We need the skill of getting things done. This is the discipline of personal effectiveness, and it provides the solution to the three main causes that get us stuck in our productivity. Exercise. What is your experience with personal effectiveness? Has it been positive or negative? Write down your thoughts. Chapter 5. Understanding Urgency and Importance for Real. What it really means to act from priorities. What is important is seldom urgent, and what is urgent is seldom important. Dwight D. Eisenhower. We hear certain concepts so often that we think we understand them more than we do. Such is the case with urgency and importance. Very rarely do people actually dive into the actual meaning of this concept to truly understand what it means. Nevertheless, understanding urgency and importance is the essence of good time management, personal effectiveness, and getting unstuck, because this understanding leads to the foundation we need in order to use personal leadership and personal management effectively in our lives. Understanding urgency and importance will get us to the heart of personal effectiveness, and thus the ability to get unstuck, especially from busyness. Although I didn't have space to address it in What's Best Next, it is a crucial concept that underlies everything I wrote there, and which I will now address in detail. You have to choose. First, we need to recognize that we have to choose what we will do with our time. That is why time management and personal effectiveness are even necessary at all. If there were no limits, if we could do anything and everything we wanted, and even all the things we didn't want to do that we had to do, there would be no need for time management. But we can't do everything. The root issue is not that we don't have enough time. If you had an extra hour every day, if each day was 25 hours long instead of 24, would you feel less stressed and not pulled in as many directions? I doubt it. A lot of us would waste that extra hour. Others might feel that they need an extra 5 hours. Some of us would start projects we think would only take an hour, but would actually take 5, thus leaving us with a desire for a 29-hour day the next day. Yeah, that's me. The fundamental issue, then, is not that we need more time, although I admit that is important and does play a part, but rather how we use our time. And that leads us to the central time management concept, setting priorities. I came to see this a few years ago in a way I will never forget. I was feeling utterly overwhelmed. I was in the midst of my health problems, and my inbox was backed up by about 4 weeks, both physical and email. I simply did not have the energy I normally had, and nothing I did was helping. I was expressing this challenge to someone, and they said, "Well, would it help if you set priorities?" I thought, "Well, I guess there is no other way." That was very sensible advice from a non-expert in time management, which I had been overlooking. Since there is not enough time for everything, there is no escaping the need to set priorities. The question is, how are we going to choose? What importance versus urgency actually means. Two factors influence the choices we make about how we spend our time: urgency and importance. Just because something is urgent doesn't mean that it is important. The urgent, in fact, often crowds out the important. The key to effective time management is to avoid becoming dominated by the urgent. Instead, know what's important and do that. Sounds simple enough. So why aren't we better at it? To answer that question, we need to delve deeper into the meanings and roles of urgency and importance. Understanding urgency. Urgent things demand our immediate action. A knock at the door, the buzz of a text message, or the pressure of a deadline are all examples of things that are urgent. All of these things represent urgency. The central thing about urgency is this: urgent things press upon us. That is a key part of what draws us to do them. Because they come with pressure, there is a built-in urge to address and resolve urgent issues. Or we may be inclined to deal with urgent things quickly because doing so can make us feel affirmed and validated. Many people get their sense of value from urgency because busyness is often seen as a symbol of importance. We think that if we are busy, we must be important, and that feels good. Understanding importance. Important things, on the other hand, are in line with our goals, life vision, and correct principles. They make the biggest difference and create a long-term impact. Unlike urgent things, important things do not press upon us. That is a fundamental distinction between urgency and importance. Urgent things press upon us, pressuring us to act. Important things do not press upon us, and thus we easily put them off until later. As Stephen Covey notes, when urgency is the dominant factor in our lives, importance isn't. And that's the problem. Urgency crowds out importance. The reason you aren't making more progress on what matters most to you is because urgency is crowding it out. You are letting urgency crowd it out. We can see this more fully by taking a look at what is commonly called the four quadrants of time management. The four quadrants. The horizontal axis is urgent and not urgent. The vertical axis is important and not important. In the upper left quadrant, quadrant 1, is important and urgent, the quadrant of immediate needs and challenges. The upper right quadrant, quadrant 2, is important but not urgent, the quadrant of impact, growth, and increasing capacity. The lower left quadrant, quadrant 3, urgent but not important, the quadrant of deception. And the lower right quadrant, quadrant 4, not important or urgent, the quadrant of waste and deterioration. Quadrant 1, urgent and important. The things in quadrant 1 are both urgent and important. That is, they are in sync with your goals, and they are pressing upon you. Examples here include such things as a crying baby, a quarterly update to the board on Thursday morning, and your website being down. Note that this quadrant is not bad in itself. If we ignore it, we will become buried alive, a very real form of being stuck. This is a quadrant where we produce, get things done, manage, and, as Covey words it so well, generally bring our experience and judgment to bear in responding to many needs and challenges. This quadrant matters. We don't need to create a false dichotomy between urgency and importance. While it is essential that we recognize the difference, it is indeed possible for something to be both urgent and important. Urgent should not be automatically taken to mean not important, a mistake that I myself am easily prone to make. The question is why you are in this quadrant. Are you here by choice, or are you here by default? You should be here because you are choosing to be, not because you are simply following the latest and loudest. Quadrant 2, important but not urgent. Quadrant 2 tells us that not everything that is urgent is important, and not everything that is important is urgent. Examples here are preparation, planning, anticipating problems, personal and organizational development, proactively thinking about how we can help others, and things like these. When you are in this quadrant, you are doing activities of high impact, and in fact, increasing your capacity to produce. Things like taking time as a team to learn how to collaborate better may not feel like they have an immediate payoff, but over the long term, you will have less frustration, and more ideas from people will be unleashed and executed better. The payoff in this category is very large, but tends to happen over the long term and is therefore harder to see and easier to forget. The fascinating thing about this quadrant is that spending more time here will result in having to spend less time in quadrant 1. In other words, investing in quadrant 2 shrinks quadrant 1. So if you want to spend less time rushing around and feel less hurried and pressed and stressed, invest in quadrant 2. On the other hand, if you ignore this quadrant, quadrant 1 will grow. You will have more stress and risk of burnout. By acting in quadrant 2, you can take care of things before they become urgent. This is key. Things often become important and urgent because they weren't taken care of when they were important and not urgent. Quadrant 2 is really about getting the effects and results of Quadrant 1 without the pain and stress that come from the added urgency. The difficulty of Quadrant 2, however, is this. This quadrant does not act upon us. It does not press upon us. Therefore, doing the important but not urgent takes personal leadership and character. You have to act. You cannot wait for or rely on others to nudge you. You are responsible. Quadrant 3, urgent but not important. Quadrant 3 is the quadrant of deception, as Covey calls it. It is the phantom of quadrant 1. We feel we are getting important things done, but that is only an illusion, because the noise of urgency creates the illusion of importance. To be operating in this quadrant is to be hijacked by the priorities of others. The activities here are only important to someone else and do not align with your goals and priorities. I received a phone call the other day from my health insurance company asking me to call them back to talk about some of the new aspects of their program. That might be important to them, but I didn't want to spend my time on that. I know how to stay healthy, and I don't need to let them add more things to my plate. They even tried to make me feel guilty by saying, "We tried to call you several times." It doesn't matter. I'm still not calling back. Microsoft Office emailed me several times and even called me twice, wanting to explain how their new office works. I don't need that, and I don't have time for it. And one salesperson recently emailed me 9 times and called me 4 times. He tried to use various forms of pressure to get me to set up a meeting with him. Now, it is not Christian to look down on that. He is an important person in the image of God. But it is important to realize, without judging him, that these are slightly shady attempts at pressuring me into giving away time that I don't have, when I've already determined I don't need the services they have to offer. More and more, certain apps are also trying to rope us in through urgency by the way they use notifications to get our attention. Quadrant 4. Not urgent and not important. Quadrant 4 is the quadrant of waste. The things here don't even have urgency going for them. When we feel deluged by the urgent, we often escape to this category for a sense of relief. Watching too much TV, mindlessly surfing the web and watching YouTube, and things like this are examples of things in this quadrant. The big problem is that these things don't provide the relief they promise. They actually make us feel worse. This is the quadrant of deterioration. The Matrix was not invented by Stephen Covey. Stephen Covey is perhaps best known for popularizing the urgency importance matrix, but it didn't start with him. In fact, the matrix itself seems to have started with President Dwight Eisenhower, which is why it is sometimes called the Eisenhower Matrix. Yet the concepts go back further than that. For example, we even see echoes of them in the writings of the great 18th century pastor and theologian Jonathan Edwards, who wrote in his journal, "To allow everything its proportion of thought, according to its urgency and importance." Edwards is best known for the theological impact he has made on the church, as perhaps America's greatest intellectual. What is sometimes overlooked about Edwards, and which could help us quite a bit, is that he was also a master of managing his time. And here we see that he explicitly sought to make time management decisions, especially in the case of his studies, which is the context of the quote, on the basis of the two chief factors of urgency and importance. Elsewhere he writes, "My time is so short that I have not time to perfect myself in all my studies, wherefore resolved to omit and put off all but the most important and needful studies." Here we see once again that Edwards made his decisions on the basis of importance. This, in great part, is a key reason for his success and influence. Why we often act on the basis of urgency. If the key to personal effectiveness is to do what is important instead of what is merely urgent, then why don't we do it more? Why aren't we better at it? There are at least 5 reasons. The first reason why we don't always choose important over urgent is that we all too easily fall for the notion that because something is urgent, it must be important as well. Stephen Covey puts this best. The noise of urgency creates the illusion of importance. In other words, we determine that something is important because of its urgency, rather than using more accurate criteria for determining importance. The solution here is to be on guard against this tendency and this illusion, and to know what the criteria are for determining whether something actually is important. See Chapter 6. Second, as I mentioned previously, urgent things are often easier and more interesting. If you get a text message while you are working on a difficult PowerPoint presentation for an upcoming meeting, the text probably sparks your curiosity. You want to know who is texting you and what the text says. It makes for an enticing distraction. Third, as we also saw previously, sometimes we fall into the trap of getting our sense of importance from the urgent. We think that if we are busy, we must be important. Fourth, society reinforces the primacy of the urgent. We often receive pressure from others to act on the basis of urgency. This false notion promotes the idea that real work consists of constantly responding to people, answering every email within an hour, and so forth. And we ourselves may use urgency to motivate other people because we don't know a better way. But guilt only works short term. Fifth, technology, especially smartphones, is reinforcing responding to the urgent. The choice architecture, which is the way apps are designed to lead you to act, is all about trying to tempt us to do things right now, as one person has put it. The app designers don't care about what will affect your long-term productivity. They just want your attention and interaction right now. And technology enables society to exert pressure all the more, because now if you aren't doing the urgent things, people can text you right away about it, making you feel guilty and behind, and perhaps goading you into action. Now, remember, urgency does have its place. The issue is, what is your dominant perspective? When urgency is dominant, then once the urgent things go away, instead of choosing to move back to important but not urgent items, you start to invent more urgent but not important items. You are driven by a quest for what is urgent, rather than being driven by a desire to do what is important. You need to be able to say no to the social pressure, and learning the difference between urgency and importance enables you to do that. The problem with traditional time management. Traditional approaches to time management rarely solve our time management problems. They promise that if we can do things faster and more efficiently, if we can get more things done in less time, we will gain a sense of control and relaxed productivity. These approaches are fundamentally inadequate. And now we can see why. Traditional time management approaches still rely too heavily on urgency. Before practices for increasing our efficiency will work, we need an entire shift in perspective so that we are using this greater efficiency for the right things. Being more efficient at shuffling around the urgent will not help. We need to be more efficient at getting the right things done, not just the latest and loudest. What acting from priorities really means. As an example of how traditional time management is stuck in the urgency paradigm, consider something that is often recommended by it, and at first looks like it has things right. Prioritizing. We are often exhorted to create a to-do list, and then to prioritize that list. Put an A next to the top priorities, a B next to the medium ones, and a C next to the ones you will get to if you can. And then delegate those lowly Ds and eliminate the poor Es. Isn't this bringing us into the importance paradigm? It may look like it, because you are prioritizing. But it really isn't, because all you are doing is prioritizing the urgent. Hence, you still have not necessarily broken free from the urgency paradigm when you are prioritizing your lists. To take the urgent things in front of you and assign priorities to them is still to be stuck in the urgency paradigm. What you need to do is ask, what should be on my list but isn't? And what is here but shouldn't be? And you need to have a mindset and criteria that enable you to make those decisions on the basis of importance. That is what it really means to act from priorities and on the basis of importance. We can now boil this down. The reason we get stuck in our time management is because we act on the basis of urgency rather than importance. The question now is, how do we know what's important? That's next. The Unstuck Clinic. Core point. Acting from priorities does not mean you take what is pressing on you and in front of you on your list and prioritize it. If you do that, you may simply be prioritizing the urgent and not doing anything important. Acting on the basis of priorities means, instead, asking, what is important? Then, you put those things on your list and prioritize those. Doing so requires having criteria for knowing what is important. Exercise. What is your fundamental way of operating? Urgency or importance? Describe a time you acted out of urgency alone. Describe a time you acted on the basis of importance. Chapter 6. Character, the great unsticking force. The way to get unstuck at the deepest and fullest level comes from changing your paradigm, which has to do with character more than technique. There is no shortcut, but there is a path. Stephen Covey. If the key to personal effectiveness and productivity is to act on the basis of importance, how do we know what's important? How do we know what the right priorities are? Is importance something we define, or is it objective? This question is more sophisticated than we might at first think, for powerful forces are at work driving us toward urgency and unimportant things, which, therefore, get us stuck. We need to understand how these forces work if we are going to truly get unstuck. The place of paradigms. A word that some claim has been way overused, but which I would argue has been even more misunderstood, is paradigm. One time management book gives a short review of Stephen Covey's First Things First at the end. Their chief critique is that it uses the word paradigm too much. Paradigm came to be seen as a superficial buzzword by many people in the 1990s, much like strategy, proactive, and synergy. But as I argue in my What's Best Next post, in defense of buzzwords, sort of, the problem is not with the words, it's with the way certain people use them. The originators of the terms use them well. They defined what they meant and showed that these are indeed very powerful concepts. That is not something that should be disparaged. Rather, it should be commended. But then, what happened, as often happens with powerful concepts, is that people started using them without knowing what they actually meant. Maybe they did this to look smart, or maybe they just weren't good at explaining themselves. Regardless of the reason, these terms then got a reputation of being meaningless buzzwords. Not because the concepts were wrong or bad or cliché, but because the words were being used divorced from their real meanings, and so many people threw the baby out with the bathwater. These terms need to be recovered because they embody rich, meaningful, and effective concepts that we all need. Paradigm is one such word. What a paradigm is. In brief, a paradigm is the way you see the world. It is your understanding of what really matters, why we are here, and what is going on. The more common term for paradigm today is worldview. Your paradigm is the rock-bottom convictions you have. They go to your root. Your paradigm includes more than just your cognitive beliefs about ultimate issues. It also encompasses your desires and loves. That is, your paradigm and worldview are not purely cognitive realities, but are also emotional. Your paradigm is the way you see things. It is the glasses through which you view the world and the assumptions you hold. Everything else you do stems from your paradigm. Your paradigm, the way you see the world, is behind not just your actions, but also your attitudes. Covey states this very well. Our paradigms are the maps of our minds and hearts, out of which our attitudes and behaviors and the results in our lives grow. The way we see, our paradigm, leads to what we do, our attitudes and behaviors, and what we do leads to the results we get in our lives. Christian philosopher Ronald Nash says a worldview is a conceptual scheme that contains our fundamental beliefs. It is also the means by which we interpret and judge reality. He goes on, worldviews function much like eyeglasses. The right eyeglasses can put the world into clearer focus, and the correct worldview can do something similar. Nash summarizes well that there are five clusters of beliefs in any worldview: God, metaphysics, epistemology, ethics, and human nature. Our view of history could be added to this as well. Metaphysics is our view of ultimate issues. Epistemology is our view of how we know what we know. The ethical component is not just about what is right and wrong. It is about why those things are right